Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. Many months ago, I had the bright idea, or so it seemed at the time, to start an A to Z of snooker. And we've finally made it halfway. We got to M in the last edition. We're now down to N. I gathered together recently in Clandidno some of the finest brains in snooker, Phil Yates, Neil Folds and Alan McManus. And we make it through a few more letters of the alphabet. I'm hoping that this will be sorted out before Brexit, although who knows. Okay, N is for non-ranking events. Now, we talk a lot about ranking tournaments and we rank players by the amount of ranking tournaments they've won. But there have been a hell of a lot of invitation events that are very prestigious. The Masters, obviously, which Alan has won, is the leading one. The Irish Masters was a huge event. And it's worth sort of recognising, Phil, a lot of these tournaments have come and gone, but, you know, they all count. You won a trophy.
They were great tournaments, and let's not forget Neil, who won the first Dubai duty-free Masters, and also the Regal Scottish Masters, which was the traditional sort of season opener for a while, and that was a superb event as well. I think any time you get the elite together, whether it's for ranking points or for big money or whatever, it's going to be a good tournament. And they were, but they don't really exist that often now, do they? It's just the Masters, and basically that's it.
Was there sort of, as a player, was the focus any different? Were you not playing for your ranking?
Yeah, I was pleased to win those two, actually. My main memory of that, it was the first ever tournament in Dubai, and then the next year, we weren't allowed to play in it. Barry boycotted it, interestingly, which is funny now, thinking about the way that things have changed in the game. He said that none of the Matchroom players could play in it because I think he felt that the tournament had been taken off him by the WSA, who he now works with. Anyway, that was what happened there. And winning them the other event, next year, trying to defend it, I come against Angles, which is not the draw I've
just won.
No, in the Scottish.
Yeah.
But no, they're good events. The other one I remember, which fell by the wayside, we talk about snooker in Belgium, the Humo Masters was quite a big event for a while. You know, that was a good tournament. I lost in the final to Mike Hallett in that one, but it was a very nice event, and people think that maybe, you know, snooker in Belgium is a new thing. Actually, that was in about 1990, and there was a lot of people interested in the game in that part of the world then.
Interesting, actually, they mentioned that part of the world. In Germany, I played the European League back then. It was kind of invite top 8 or 10 or whatever it was, but they also invited a few European amateurs, which was good. I remember playing in Hamburg, and we were talking about it last night, actually. They were hanging from the rafters, actually, watching it. I've always thought, let's have a tournament in Hamburg, you know, because it was amazing. The crowds, I couldn't believe it. It was actually the famous night when Jimmy played the Massey shot, I think it's on YouTube. That was in Hamburg, and you can sort of hear the crowd. It was awesome over there.
I did the World Mixed Doubles Championship in Hamburg at Green Snooker Club, and again, it was absolutely packed, and they've got a tradition out there. They, rather than clap to show their appreciation, they stamp their feet. And we got the locked-off camera on the trophy at the end of the match, and they were all stamping their feet, and the camera was going all over the place because, you know, obviously the stuff it was mounted on was moving as well. It was a great atmosphere, really good, and I agree with Alan. I think it would be a tremendous place to go to.
Actually, a quick story about the Regal Masters that you're talking about. I've got a funny memory from it, actually. I lost in the final twice. I lost to Ken, and I lost to Bondi, and Nigel beat me. I think it was 9-8 or 10-9. He beat me in the decider, and I got drug tested, as is normally, you know, both finalists. And a couple of my mates came along, so it was about 15 miles from where I lived. So I got a drug test, had a couple of beers because I'd lost, and you're supposed to remain on site to do the drug test. Actually, a couple of my mates, I couldn't go to the loo, so, you know, it was like I had to just wait around, waiting, having a couple of beers, and they said, and I lost my kind of thought, probably through the beer, and they said, oh, come on, we'll just go back home. So I went home, and I got a phone call about 2 in the morning, said, listen, you've got a drug test to do, you can't leave the premises, otherwise you might be in trouble. The guy actually drove out to my house, but back then there was no like Google Earth or what, you know, there was no internet. So he took about an hour and a half to find my house. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and we were still having a few beers, me and my mates. So I did the drug test in my own house, It was like it was weird, you know, about four o'clock in the morning. But they were good tournaments. Yeah.
Well, I would just finally on this Goffs, we have to mention.
Yeah, I was going to say
the Irish Masters. I mean, that was an incredible venue for snooker, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I played Ken there, which was he got a huge reception. I played Alex Higgins there the time when he had the bad leg, and I lost to him, and I thought this is no good. I've got beat by a fellow on one leg here. I know he had everyone on his side, but then he went on and won it, so I didn't feel quite as bad about that. That was a great event. I lost in the final of that to Davis once. Davis won it, I think, a lot, didn't he? 8 times or something.
Yeah, he beat me twice in the final.
Yeah. I mean, that was a terrific tournament actually, and you know, I think that was quite a special invitational event. You know, as is the Masters, still is, because you felt like you were going over there to something that was quite important. I think the final point I would say on that, it didn't seem to matter that it wasn't a ranking event. You know, it didn't seem to matter. It meant a lot to be involved in it.
Well, I'm going to throw you, Phil, a hot potato, okay? Because we're at the Tour Championship. This is a 8-man event, ranking event, you know, Players Championship, 16-man ranking event. Should the Masters now be a ranking event?
I don't think so. And I'll tell you why. Because it's based on 2-year rankings. So in that 2-year rankings, there's the World Championship, where 16 players are seeded into the last 32. So everybody doesn't start on a level playing field. Whereas for this one, all of the tournaments that count for this, for the World Grand Prix, and indeed for the Players' Championship, start in the 1-2-8. So everybody's on a level playing field. So you could actually say that the Masters is slightly different because it's a 2-year list. I mean, it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to make it a world ranking event. And certainly, if they did, you wouldn't hear any great protest from me, but I think that's one of the reasons why it isn't.
But yeah, but that doesn't matter anymore, does it? Because if you said it was going to be a ranking event the year after next, then everyone's got the same chance of being in the 16 for the year before, haven't they?
Strictly speaking, they actually don't, because a first year pro has got, what, 6 or 7 months to get in it?
Yeah, good point, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're saying no then, are we?
I did say it was a hot potato, didn't I?
I think the mystique of the event would be a little tarnished as well. I mean, let's face it.
It doesn't need to be a ranking event.
Doesn't need to be a ranking event.
Yeah, that's the final word. Okay, we move on to O, which is for 147. This season we had the 147th 147, Dave Gilbert. Rather prosaic surroundings of the Rico in Coventry. No audience or any of that. But he made it. He's on the list again. It's still a special break. I mean, we do have a lot of them, but we have a lot of snooker. And we also have a lot of players down the list who are now capable of making these big breaks.
Well, two things come to mind about 147s, which are sort of an original thought, really. One is that increasingly we're seeing players make a 147 and lose the match in question. It's remarkable how often that happens. The other one I will say is, people always ask me, what's your favourite 147? And it used to be the obvious ones, but now I'd plumb for one that is very left field. But I'm doing this because it gave the person who made it immense pleasure, more than any other 147 I've ever seen, and he won very little for it. Fergal O'Brien in the Championship League. When he made that 147, he was absolutely over the moon. There was no one there watching. It didn't mean hardly anything to anyone apart from Fergal. And he was absolutely delighted, and I was really pleased for him.
You did say left field. We go back to John Spencer, of course. He made one, and there was this thing about it, what the pockets were templated, but also the cameraman at McDonald's.
That was in Slough, I think, wasn't
it? Yeah. And Joe Johnson was there. He told me he was watching. He said that after, this was a different time, clearly, because he said after Spencer potted the last pink, he did a sort of mock feint. He lay on the floor, got up and potted the black. But then, of course, Davis, would have to be Steve, wouldn't it, to make the first one at the Larder Classic.
I have to say, I actually went to that event in Slough with my dad. I don't think that day, we were there one of the days, and I think the pockets were bigger. You could even tell that from watching it, you know, just on the sidelines. I was only a kid, but you could see the pocket. They were going in off the jaw. People were saying it. Now, nothing to take away from John Spencer, who was, three times champion of the world, great player. But so I think that's fair enough. There might have been buckets, actually, for that one. It's not a surprise that Davis made the first one, is it, really? He sort of changed so much in the game. But I think I never made one. Have you made one?
No, I never made one. I've never had one against me either. I nearly had one at the Masters 1 year when the prize was it was like an XJS Jag or something. It was a big green thing with like cream leather interior, and it looked like massive because it was in the foyer of the conference centre. And I was playing David Rowe, I remember. And I should have got one. I think I screwed the 14th black in on and off Kush for the red. And if I go past the red or hit the red full ball, I'm perfect. And I hit it half ball and left it horrible. But and it would have been nice to make one at the Masters, but so that would have been, you know.
To be honest, I don't. I mean, as much as Fergal O'Brien's was a great break, I'm sure. I can't see how that's the best one. I think Phil's just gone a bit.
Gone rogue.
not the best one, but the one that gave me the warmest feeling, certainly, and I know it did for Fergal as well.
There's never been a bad one. That's no, for sure. No, one thing no. I can say about that, there's never been a bad break. I mean, I'm going to keep it simple and say that Ronnie's won 147 in 5:20. I can't. Every time I watch it, I still can't believe how quick it was, because he didn't seem to be rushing. That's the strangest part about it.
I think the best black that's ever been potted was maybe Selby. He potted it in left middle, didn't he?
For the 100th.
That was an awesome shot. You know, usually it's like high black and you pot it, but that was, how did he land low? I don't remember, but
The last part about it would say is there's that exclusive club of players that have got to the black and missed, isn't there, as well, which is quite, I think, you know, obviously Ken is on there, he's probably the highest profile one. Chai has done it a couple of times.
Selby as well did it in Selby China. No one ever sort of mentions that, but that was on telly. He missed the last black, but he sort of redeemed himself. Obviously, what's happened is they've become more regular, so you don't get now the big money prizes. I know they have the rolling prize, but it's very rare now that rolls over to a really massive prize. Yeah.
I think people don't understand how it all worked in the old days. 147s were very, very rare, so a sponsor, say Embassy or whoever, could have a bet with a bookmaker that a 147 would be made at very, very large odds. So if you're offering, say, I don't know, £147,000 for a 147, you're actually only putting up, I don't know, 20,000, because you get 7-8 to 1. Before that, it was even bigger odds. Now you go to a tournament and maybe it's 6-4, even money, depending on the scale of the event. So they can't really afford to put those big prizes up now. It's not a matter of them being stingy or miserly or anything like that. It's just the way of the world.
I actually still say the biggest one single frame achievement in the history of the game is Jamie Burnett's 148. Because I've in practice matches all time, I've had a free ball, I think, once, maybe twice ever. And that to do it's just mind blowing, I think, you know.
And that was terrible the way he was treated, because they wanted to, they gave him
was
nothing.
No, there was no high UK, pre-TV, no high break prize in that stage. But they, so everyone thought, well, there should be a special prize, and I think in the end he didn't qualify for York, but they invited him down. Standard fare return, but and basically it was worked out. He would be there about 10 minutes. We'd have to go back again.
But part of the prize he got, which was, well, judge yourself. This is ridiculous. He was given 2 tickets to a match of his choice.
Yeah,
he's never watched a match in his life. You know,
no, it's a shame. But anyway, he's there and it'd be interesting. I mean, I suppose that's the next milestone. If someone can make a break above 147. On TV, that would be a moment, wouldn't it?
But, well, we had a 16-rate clearance at the Crucible, obviously Steve James.
But literally, I see 2 or 3 instances a season where players got a chance of that, because obviously, without telling people what they probably already know, you've got to make a foul at the start of a frame, and all 15 reds can't be hit. Well, that's quite unusual in itself, isn't it? You know, there'd have to be an unusual set of circumstances. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's. I mean, I think I had 1 or 2 opportunities in my career just on the practice table, like you say. It's very rare.
Yeah.
You went for a 147 against Willie Thorne in the English Professional Championship, about 80.
And took a liberty and went to try to swerve a red to get on the black for the 11th. And I thought I'd won the frame, and he ended up winning the frame. Got a free ball, won the frame. But, needless to say, I got the last laugh. Won the match. No one asked that question. No, I'm still saying
it's always brought up that, though, isn't it? When anyone gets to 80, well, there was one instance.
Yeah, there was, yeah. Anyway, 80, I was a bit sick.
Anyway, let's move on to P, which is for Pot Black. BBC television programme, 50 years old this year, 1969 it started. BBC Two had come in and it was the first colour TV service. The controller of BBC Two was David Attenborough, who went on to become quite famous for other things. And he commissioned this programme to showcase the colour service, and obviously snooker with its colours was perfect. And the rest literally is history, isn't it? Because that was the first exposure most people had to snooker, certainly in colour. And from there, you know, we've moved on to this multi-million pound circuit.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the thing about it was, it was all recorded over the couple of days, and it was meant to be a secret, wasn't it? Who won it? But it was brilliant. I mean, would it be a Thursday evening? It was on something like that, around about 9 o'clock, and it was the only snooker on, and you would always watch that, just one frame of snooker, the frame I remember was when Eddie Charlton made the break of 110, a couple of series in, I think. I don't know exactly the year, but. Yeah, you know, and word had got around that it happened, and no one was going to miss that episode, you know, tremendous.
I strangely remember watching it, but I don't think I'd ever played in a full-size table. I'm guessing it would have been around 79, 80, 78, 79. I can't remember who was playing. What I do remember about it was Alan Weeks was the presenter, is that right? Alan Weeks, and the little trophy. And it's obviously, I was only a kid at the time, and you think, how does every frame last only 25 minutes or whatever? Obviously, they edit it down, but I watched it, and I wasn't really into snooker. I was too young, but it sort of got me hooked, yeah.
It shows, actually, how the game has changed and evolved, because nowadays, if you had a one-frame programme lasting a half an hour, you'd have a big fill, wouldn't you, really?
Is that you?
Yeah, more than likely, yeah. But back then, quite a lot of the frames had to be edited down to fill, because, you know, if there was a lengthy safety exchange, and who could blame these guys, because that was the best exposure they were going to get all year, and that was going to give them exhibition work, because if people saw them on the telly playing well, oh, we'll book that guy. And one player it made his career was Graham Miles, who won it not once but twice, and obviously got to the final of the 74 World Championship as well.
Well, that's the thing. It was important for the game, but also for the players, because, like you say, it was a chance for them to sort of showcase themselves. Oh, I've been on the BBC, so now all of a sudden they are booked for more exhibitions, you know, as seen on TV. And in those days, there was the World Championship, and basically that was it. So you couldn't make a living from tournament play. You had to make it through the holiday camps and the exhibition circuit.
The other thing is how the world has changed. Alex Higgins was blackballed for a few series. He wasn't allowed to play in it. Now, can you imagine the TV companies now saying, oh, yeah, that's no problem. If you don't want to have Alex in, you know, don't worry, we'll go ahead anyway. They would insist on him being in because he was the rater. He was the big writer.
And of course it was Sidney Lee in the early days was the referee, wasn't it? Which, you know, that tells you how far it all goes back, really. And
But also it established the etiquette, didn't it? You know, the players in the waistcoats, the whole sort of feel of tournament snooker, which we still see today, was established then.
Yeah, terrific. I liked it. And, you know, obviously they had Junior Pot Black after that for a while, but I think the original...
You played in that, didn't you?
Yeah, a couple of times. Yeah, the first year it ever took place, I was in that. Didn't win it. John Parrott... lost in the final to Dean Reynolds. That was the very first year of it. Yeah, that was very nerve wracking. You know, I think we were 16-year-olds and hadn't played on the TV. Just terrified, really, just to be there. But it's quite very exciting.
I remember they had Pot Black. They reintroduced it. Must have been around 1992, and it was at Blackpool. Anyway, cut long story. I think it was scheduled for June, mid June, and we had a long break in the season. We didn't play until about August, September. So I was not playing. I was supposed to play in Pot Black in Blackpool. Completely forgot about it. A guy who looked after me at the time, I went in the club this day and he said, do you know where we're supposed to be right now? I said, no. He said, Blackpool, Pot Black's on. I'm like, oh, no. So I get a disciplinary letter in from the governing body. It goes down to Bristol for the disciplinary hearing. And Barry Hearn was on the board. He wasn't chairman at the time. I can't remember who. I think John Spencer was chairman. And so I thought it was all that official thing. And I've sat down. I was only about 21 at the time. They said, right, Alan, what's your explanation for not... And I said, well, the car broke down and we had a blowout in the motor and Barry Hearn just piped in. The first one, he said, oh, come on, Al, you've got to come up with better than that, son. And that's...
Yeah, I realise.
You know, that's Barry Hearn, isn't it?
I never realised Alan was such a rebel. Like, no, not done a drug test, turning up for tournaments. I don't remember any of this.
Tell us out the window.
Yeah, but he's a rebel... With a pause, okay. Not with that one.
A niche joke. They had some, towards the end, like you say, it got revived, and then they had some, it was like time frame, they called it. It was against the clock, which no one really understood how it worked, mainly the players.
They didn't have it, I won it, and they never had it again. Yeah, they said no more of this nonsense. I won that, but... It didn't seem to catch on. They had an idea. It was a bit like chess where they would... It was not like the shootout now. What it was is you would play your shot and you would stop the clock. So, but, I mean, I suppose there is possible you could do something with that now with the slow players because someone that took too long on the shot ran out of time, basically. It didn't work out. But I still I've got my name down as a winner of Pot Black and I did receive the trophy, albeit it said time frame next to it. I forgot about that.
They also had a one-frame shootout in Stoke, which was rather ridiculous, because in the final, Darren Morgan beat Mark Halley 2-1. Right, yeah. Now, work that one out.
I actually... I remember that. I was at Trentham Gardens. I drew Stephen Hendry in the first round and somehow managed to beat him. But that's what I remember about that. I remember the fight. I think I got to the semis or quarters or something, but yeah.
But this is why, in the end, Pot Black got stopped, because obviously the game had moved on and people would rather, in the end, not watch half an hour. They want to watch the World Championship over 17 days and all the other tournaments. But it played a very, very important part in the game's development. Let's move on to Q, and this is a bit of a cheat, but bear with me. Q is for Q, as in snooker Q. obviously, you know, the most important part of a player's armoury, and we've seen a lot of players over the years stick with their one trusty cue. A lot of players, on the other hand, changing their cue, messing around with the cue, getting a new cue, breaking a cue. We sort of take it for granted, don't we? We see them walking in with it, but it's a very important bit of kit.
Well, we're doing this podcast here in Llandudno, and of course this was the hometown of Fred Davis for many years. And Fred was the archetypal example of someone who kept the same cue throughout his career. He turned professional at the age of 16. He stopped playing in his very late 70s. And the cue he started with was the cue he finished with, which was remarkable, really, by modern standards. We've had a few instances over the years where people have forgotten their cues. Cliff Thorburn, do you remember that time at the Grand Prix? And I think he used John Spencer's cue. At the time, Cliff was a top player, and he lost 5-0 to Steve Newbury. He couldn't knock a ball in. So back then, it was thought if you lost your cue or it was damaged, that was you. Finished.
Well, when Stephen had his cue stolen, it was at the Hexagon, wasn't it? Right in at the point where he was the best player in the world, his cue went missing. I think he left the practice room, which was in the hotel, and went to get a drink, come back, it had gone. I mean, he reckons that he would have lost 5-0 because the cue they brought down was meant to be a replica, but Stephen was very sort of particular. He then used that, he had that same cue for many, many years, didn't he? And it turned up just in time, but he reckons that he was doing the lineup with this other cue. He couldn't make 16 with it, so it's a massive thing.
I remember that day, actually. I went in the hotel, it was called the Renaissance, upstairs from the Hexagon at the time, and there was security guys. I'd maybe done practice or something, and they stopped me on the way in and, like, not searched me, but like, who are you, why are you here, all the it was a big
I'm not surprised after all the other things after the flight, you stole it.
I know, I've still got it in my mantle. I mean, but yeah, cues are massively important. There was one, I had one funny thing that I, this is another rogue one for me, I'm, you know, a rebel. I lost in Preston one night, and the car park outside the hotel through the bus station, it was dark, it was like 10 o'clock at night, packing up the car, put my stuff in the car, my case or whatever, and you got to put your snooker cue in the, you know, through the back of the, you know, the boot of the car. And I just lost my mind, and I obviously didn't put it in. So I'm driving home, I've got to about Carlisle, which is about 80 miles north of Preston, and you look in the mirror to see the top of your cue in the back of the car. And I've gone, uh-oh, no cue. I'm like, oh, no, panicked. I've had to drive back, and it was lucky it wasn't raining, because if it's raining, the you know, your tip's going to be damaged, the cue's going to be probably damaged. So I drive back to the car park, it's pitch black, and my cue's still lying on the floor of the car park.
That old cue you used to use, he used to beat me with every time. He should have just left it there, because it was all taped up at the end.
I found it in someone's garden, they were growing pea pods.
But they also said about Hendry's cue that it was basically no good. But obviously for him it was.
Great cue,
but
no.
The people always said you would never pick it out of the rack if you were going to pick one.
I don't think it was an expensive cue, but sometimes you can pick up a nice bit of wood, you know, as a cue. I mean, I used the same cue for years as well. My cue wasn't all that, but you know, now it seems that you know, the way that they're made to such high quality, you know, you can probably get used to a new one relatively quickly.
I actually think now with cues, I've had the cue that I use now for just over 3 years, I think, a cue from Thailand. I actually think now with a modern player, a good thing is to change your cue maybe every 4 or 5 years, right? Because players now, the modern guy hits the ball that firm, it actually does sort of not deteriorate, but it changes. You know, when you pick up a brand new cue these days, it's like an iron bar, and you know, going through, you go through the white light, it's unbelievable. As time goes past, and I'm now what, 3-4 years now with my own cue, you sometimes feel this isn't hitting it as solid as it did when I first got it. So I think, and players can adapt now because cues are all very uniform, but you know, players do generally like what they've got.
From a journalistic perspective, I think the best cue story was the one in early 2006 when Graham Dott had been beaten in the Welsh Open, and he was driving home and just on the spur of the moment on a service station decided to break his cue. So he's there trying to break the cue and he just can't do it. The bloody thing won't break.
No, well, he actually hurt his leg. He put it diagonally against the wall and he couldn't break it and he hurt his leg.
He said there was a lorry driver looking at him from the cab of his lorry looking down. I said, what are you trying to do? And there he is, he's getting more and more mad trying to break the cue, and he wouldn't.
But on the sort of less funny side of that, Alain Robidoux, of course, his cue got broken, not by him. It destroyed his career, basically.
Well, he turned up at the World Championship the year after the cue was broken, I think as the world number 7, because of course then your ranking only changed once a year. Had it been under this system now, he would have been so far down the rankings he would have had to qualify. You're right, David. It absolutely decimated his career.
The thing as well with Alain's cue, as most of the Canadians used, they were cues called Dufferin. That was the name of the... And they had these fibre ferrules, the dark ferrule that Cliff used, and I think Bill and whoever else, the Canadian lads. So it was really... like, for Alain to go to maybe a one-piece ash or a two-piece maple, whatever, I think would have been really difficult with the brass ferrule and all of that. And they had that joint in the middle, the Dufferin cues. So that was apparently the guy just like he had a logo on it or something.
Yeah, Alain had put a logo on because he was being sponsored, and the person who made the cue, who was quite elderly, I think, and a bit of a traditionalist, took exception to this sort of sponsorship and just smashed it up, which was just awful, really.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. And he wasn't the same player for probably ever again. But he did eventually get used to a different cue, but it affected him. Worst for the reasons Alan explained, I think, than would anyone else in the game.
I heard one top player say, I won't say who it was, but he said that there's a case for players taking more than one cue into the arena. Now, of course, Luca Brasil did that at the Masters. It didn't work for him last year. Is there anything in that?
I don't think so. Yes. No, I mean, I remember one guy, Robbie Grace, who when I first turned pro, he had two ash cues, two one-piece ash cues. And he used to stand just before going out and with one in each hand and think, that one, nah, I'll go with that one. And he would, but that wouldn't happen nowadays. I think no matter how uniform a cue maker gets, that, a piece of wood I see as a, snooker geek as a kind of living, breathing thing. So you don't get two the same.
So how could it? I'm trying to think. You're not going to say who it was, but whoever it is, he's clearly a lunatic. No, you're right not to name him. That's not the right thing to do.
No. I'm not going to say
best
that.
Not.
Well, not after you've called him a lunatic. But of course, we talked about Hendry. I mean, he was never really the same after his cue got broke. He got broke by baggage handlers at Heathrow, sort of ignominious end.
Yeah, he won tournaments with the new cue, but the old one was part of the armoury, wasn't it? It was part of the arm. Yeah. Part of his body had felt like, symbiosis, whatever they call it. But yeah, he wasn't the same player, although he did win events. But yeah, I mean, back then, the thought process was, if your cue was damaged, it could basically be terminal for your career. That was what the general assumption was.
There was sort of... So one last thing on that I was going to say is that when I was sort of doing okay at the game, they came to one of the cue manufacturers and said, we're going to try and pioneer a graphite cue, and if you can put your name to it. I thought, this could be good, couldn't it? So they gave me the prototype, and honestly, it was unusable. You couldn't break off with it. And you'd break off, you'd hit the pink four ball, or you'd go the other way and you'd miss the red. It was just impossible to use a graphite cue. In any way, it just did not play anything like an ash or maple cue. So that quickly disappeared.
Just one final point, Alan. Obviously, you're very much still playing, and you'll be aware of this. Travelling abroad now, you can't take your cue on with you. You can't carry the cue onto the plane. So there's that anxiety when you get to the other end, particularly in China, and maybe you've had an internal flight. Is it going to turn up?
Well, that... Fortunately, touch wood, I've not had a cue not turn up so far. But my last time I was out in China, just before Christmas, I got out there, went on the practice table, and my ferrule started pinging when I was hitting the ball. The reason, I think, is when it's in the hold for 10 hours, it's minus whatever under there, it's really cold. Obviously, wood shrinks over that period of time, so the ferrule now is actually loose, and that, so it's not a... Not a good thing, but that, me being a snooker geek, I actually have made a kind of fibre cover for my cue to put in my case. It's like it's like insulation to put your cue in your cue case and then in your sport tube that hopefully will stop the wood from shrinking and causing a problem.
But what if your cue ends up getting you lost in the baggage? That doesn't matter, does it? Really, all that there's no help to you.
No, but if it does turn up, it might not pick. But I was one other quick thing on that. The cues, sorry, a player who I won't mention, he left his cue overnight back home on the table, on the bed of his table, and the heaters were on overnight. And he came in the next day and his cue was like a boomerang. He spent 2 days, bending it back into shape, and he got it, thankfully, back into shape. So you've got to be careful. And me, again, being the geek, when I put my cue in my cue case, I turn it 90 degrees every day. I mean, that'll sound really, far out. But and Neil Folgy's got his head in his hands. The reason is so that I just think if you turn it 90 degrees every day, then it'll stay straight over time.
Does that not make sense?
That lad knew it was a boomerang because he threw it away and it came back to him. Yeah.
And on that joke, we're going to end. Thank you very much. We're making progress. By about 2023, we should have this alphabet finished. Thank you.